Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the third of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George Shultz and Hoover Institution Senior Fellow Shelby Steele. Originally recorded in 2006, the two discuss Shultz's role as Secretary of Labor in the Nixon administration. Shultz goes further to reveal personal experiences in the Reagan administration that formed his thinking on civil rights and discrimination. We hope you enjoy this week's episode, and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, George, today, and have this opportunity to talk to you about all sorts of things that I think are important to others and that I'm certainly curious about. Why don't we begin by, I've always been interested in your role in the Nixon administration, in the race problem, and how you got involved in it, and were there any events or occurrences or experiences before your time with Nixon that shaped your view on civil rights in any way?
Well, I had three experiences before I went into the Nixon administration that had an impact on my thinking. I was co-chairman with Clark Kerr when I was at the University of Chicago of something called the Armor Automation Fund. The unions and the company had gotten together and they created this fund. And Clark and I were the co-chairmen. It was supposed to deal with problems that resulted from plant closings and things like that. So a plant closed in Fort Worth, Texas. And I went down there with a group, management representative, union representative, person that I was working with named Arnie Weber, who's really a terrific guy. The four of us go down there. The union representative was black. So we all are staying at the same hotel. We go to the hotel before we were gonna go to our work. And I give my name and check in. They say, we have a nice suite for you. And the management guy does, and Arnie does. Then the union guy does, and the clerk looks at him. He says, well, we don't have a room for you. And unlike the rest of us, he'd been in that position before, and he whipped out a confirmed reservation slip. He said, I have a confirmed reservation. I paid a deposit. And the clerk was a little baffled. So he disappeared to the management. He came back and he said, well, I'm sorry, we just don't have a room. And I said, well, you gave me a suite. So there are two rooms. And you can put a bed, another bed in one of them, so you do have a room, register him. So he registered.
So he managed to get in that hotel.
So apparently that was the first time that had happened.
I wonder how they rationalized that.
I don't know how they rationalized it, but you hear about discrimination in your mind, but this was an experience.
Yes.
And it also said to me, confront it. Don't just say, well, all right, that's the deal, deal. You try to do something about it and something can happen.
So that was one of the first formative experiences then.
And the second one was a little different. This was the result of an agreement that Clark and I had mediated with them, having to do with older workers with a lot of seniority having bumping rights into another plant if they wanted to go there if their plant was closed. So that was in the contract. And the company built a new plant in a little town called Worthington, Minnesota, very small town. And it was very appealing to the town because meatpacking jobs paid pretty well, relatively, and they're going to get a new plant. So the plant is about finished, and the company announced the closing of its plant in Kansas City. And at that plant, been there a long time, I would guess 80% of the people who worked there were black. So the senior ones had bumping rights. So we looked into it. In this little town, there were only white people there. It wasn't that they had negative experience, positive. No, they had no experience. It was just it was a total blank. Although this was at a time when all the riots were going on in Watts and such places.
The mid-60s and...
Right. Yeah. So what happened? We went up, we talked about it and so on, but workers from the Kansas City plant sent little scouts out. Families would go out to see what was this town like. And they met people. And then the townspeople started reading all the riots. People came. The governor of Minnesota had a human rights consultant and came to the town. And we had to run him out of town because he just seemed to be trying to cause people to see problems. And all of a sudden, the people, these elders in the plan town said, you know, the big cities, they don't know how to do anything. But we're in this town, we're proud of our town. And these people have bumping rights into this plant, so let them come. And so...
How many people were they talking about, roughly?
Well, roughly 40 or 50 people came. Oh, so it was very...
Significant
end,
number.
A lot more were entitled to come. Then the question, well, where were they going to live? And there was some new development. Somebody said, well, they're there. Mm-hmm. And the town father said, I don't know, we don't want to do that. That just creates a ghetto. We want them to live out around in the community like everybody else and be part of the community. Wow. Then the churches learned that many of them were tithers. So they started competing for the tithers. And everything worked out. It worked.
That's interesting.
And it was kind of a man bites dog thing. Everything was going wrong everywhere. So Clark and I were in New York about 6 or 8 months after this was going on. And a friend of ours was a man named Abe Raskin. He was by that time on the editorial board of the New York Times, but he had been a labor writer and had followed our automation committee work, which was innovative. Mm-hmm. And we told him about this. He got curious, so he went out to Worthington, Minnesota to see for himself. And he came back and he wrote front page story in the New York Times.
Wow.
By way of saying, all the reporting is about negative things. Here's something that worked. It can work.
My goodness.
People can get along.
Yeah. My goodness.
So then the NBC decided to do something about it, and they took their cameras and they went up there trying to provoke people to say something negative.
Wow.
And the community people called us, both everybody, and said, can't you get these guys out of here?
Yeah.
We just want to be let alone. We don't want any publicity. We're getting along fine. But that had a big impact. You know, things could happen.
If you give people a chance. Yeah.
Then I had another experience. And
people
when
have
I was
a good nature. In
dean
some ways.
At the University of Chicago, we had no blacks in our MBA program. Mm-hmm. Not because we were turning them down, that nobody applied.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was bad. So I went on a little research trip to places where there were a lot of undergraduates and talked to them and said, why don't you apply? And they said, well, there are two reasons. Number one, it's too expensive. And number two, we don't think there's a job at the end of the rainbow. And you find out they don't have any uncle or brother or whatever, it's any point of reference.
Right.
So I got 6 or 8 companies whose names were recognizable to put up money and to guarantee a job in the summer between the first and second MBA year.
Mm-hmm.
But not at the end, but in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no commitment on the part of the person that they would take a job.
Right.
But anyway, there was a job there.
Uh-huh.
And so then we went around and recruited, and I was recruiting people who were clearly able to be admitted on their merits.
This was in the late 60s?
This was in the mid-60s or so.
Mid-60s, uh-huh.
And we identified quite a few people, and they applied, got these fellowships. And people turned out quite well. And one of them, a guy named Ron Brooks, terrific guy, he wound up running the computer thing at the University of Chicago. Then he came with me and he became the economist at OMB.
Wow.
Then he came to with me when I was Secretary of the Treasury and he was an economic advisor there. He was very good, turned out well.
Yeah.
So all of this told me there are things you can do that can work.
Well, you seem to have always had a sort of innate sense of fairness around these issues. Was there something even earlier in your family life or childhood that encouraged? Many people in America did not have that sort of attitude, certainly at that point in time, and were sort of reluctantly drawn into the civil rights ideas. But you seem to have sort of had it in an innate way. Was there anything?
Well, I don't know. Not.
Parents
some,
were?
Some of my, well, my on my mother's side, her father and her uncle were both ministers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that had kind of an impact. I don't know, but I didn't consider these three things stand out in my mind now. But I didn't consider them particularly remarkable. Mm-hmm. They just sort of happened, and it was kind of, what else would you do? You got to go out and you got to do something.
I can tell you, a lot of people didn't at that point. Well, the truth is, my experience has always been somewhat similar to that. That there were people of goodwill in many places that were often surprising and were willing to do that kind of thing.
But I thought the town elders in this little town were wonderful.
I mean,
they said, these big city people, they don't know how to do anything, but in our town, we do it right.
We do it right. Yeah,
it was very. Rewarding experience.
Well, in the Nixon years, you seemed to be the person in the administration that almost carried the banner for these kinds of issues. How did that start? Was that something that was encouraged by the president himself, or how did that work?
The president had a lot to do. You don't do anything important if the president doesn't agree with it.
Yeah, indeed.
So, he gave me a certain amount of running room, but everything I did, he was fully informed. But I remember we had, in the Labor Department, we had something called the Philadelphia Plan for the construction trades.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you got to have some goals. And you got to have some timetables. And I remember being called to testify before a Senate committee.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I'm confronted with a man named Phil Kurland, who was the ablest of a very able bunch of lawyers at the University of Chicago Law School. And I knew him, and he's peering down at me. I know this guy's got a mind a lot better than mine. And he said, you are trying to institute a quota system. I said, no, I'm not. I'm trying to eliminate one.
Mm-hmm.
And that took him back. He said, what do you mean you're trying to eliminate one? I said, there's been a quota system here for a long time.
Yeah.
It's been very effective.
Yeah.
So what's the quota? I said, zero.
Yeah.
The quota.
Yeah.
So somehow you got to break through that.
Yes.
These things can easily deteriorate into a quota system. So I don't think that's a good thing. But anyway, the way you manage, I mean, you're going to manage something other. How do you do it? You set objectives, don't you?
Yeah.
Say, I want to get here by that time.
Yeah. Well, I can, my own father, who drove a truck in Chicago for his whole working life, could not get into the Teamsters Union until 2 weeks before he retired. He begged them and begged them. Finally, he got in and got his retirement. But he'd worked for 40 years driving a truck, but it took the last 2 weeks, finally, the Teamsters opened up and took him in. So it took a good deal of pressure to get unions to open up in those days. I can remember that.
I think things have really changed a lot.
Yeah.
And I have two very good friends, Colin Powell and Condi Rice. You know Condi, our colleague here at Hoover. And the thing that I enjoy particularly about the positions they have been in and are in is that everybody realized they're there because of their capability.
Yes.
They didn't get picked
because
of their race. They got picked because they're capable.
Yes.
And that's where we want to get.
Yeah.
But it takes a while to get there.
Well, I agree with you. Those are two people who sort of make that argument that they're there because of their capability. And And thus they represent a major advance, I think, in American life. And you wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times not too long ago, I think it may be 2 or 3 years ago, talking about your involvement with desegregation in the South. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I found that interesting. There was a lot of reluctance in the South to finally...
Well, here we had the Brown decision.
Yeah.
That basically said that segregated schools were to be a thing of the past.
Yeah.
And I forget the date of the Brown decision. That was a long time before Nixon was in office anyway. 1970 comes along, and President Nixon decided there's 7 southern states where the schools were segregated by law. You couldn't run an integrated school. That the time had come to end that. And what went into all his reasoning, I don't know, but he decided that in the early summer. And he appointed a cabinet committee to manage it. And he appointed the vice president, who was then Spiro Agnew, to be the chairman, and me to be the vice chairman. I was Secretary of Labor. Agnew said, I don't want any part of this. This is not my issue. I won't even meet. So I became the de facto chairman. And I had, at that time, Pat Moynihan was in the White House and a guy named Len Garman.
Oh, sure.
Don Rumsfeld was head of the Office of Economic Opportunity. Anyway.
Was he?
We went to work on it. And we decided to form biracial committees in each of the states. And our object was to get what we call real people. That is, not people who went around agreeing with each other all the time, but people who represented constituencies and felt strongly about it and were good people, substantial people.
Yeah.
So the first group to come up was from Mississippi, 50-50 representation. So they came into the Roosevelt Room in the White House, and I started in with them. And we started discussing the merits of what was going to happen, and they argued. So I let them argue for a while, maybe an hour and a half or so. Then I had it set up that when I thought the moment was right, the Attorney General, who was then John Mitchell, would come into the room. So John would come in. And the white people in the South thought he was their guy. Southern strategy. So I'd say, John, Mr. Attorney General, what are you going to do when the schools open? And he said, I'm going to enforce the law. Thank you very much. Go away. So then I'd say, well, it's been an interesting discussion. And everybody's had their views, but it's kind of irrelevant because it's going to happen. And what's the question now? Well, the question, it seems to me, is how's it going to work? And you are a banker, you're in this town, and if the schools go to hell and there's a lot of violence, it's not very good for your banking business. So on around. And so they start to talk about what kind of problems might arise and how would you handle them. We had a little money that could be used to build this or do that. And so they got discussing how you're going to solve a problem. And they'd get to a certain point when they were really working together and talking together constructively. And we'd get a signal and go across the hall into the Oval Office, and there's the president. And President Nixon was magnificent in these things. And he'd say, well, here we are in the Oval Office, and think of the decisions that have been made in this office. And here we have this huge issue of education and equality in education. And I've made my decision. But in our kind of a country, it's not enough for what the president decides. People in the states and the communities, you have to decide too what you're going to do. And we have to do this together because we all have a role to play here. And I'm with you, but you have to respond. And by the time he got through, everybody was up on cloud nine.
Wow.
So we went out and they worked.
People don't know that. People,
no, they don't.
People do not know that.
But then I got a scare, because there were seven states involved. We went through six, and it all went well. So I became very confident. And I said to the president, "Why don't we, the last one is in Louisiana." And it was about a week and a half or so before the school openings would start. So I said, "Why don't we go down to Louisiana, and I'll meet with the Louisiana group, and you can come in at the end, and then we'll get the co-chairman of each of these committees from all the states to come. We'll have a meeting of all of them. It'd be kind of a kickoff, goodwill kickoff for the opening of the school season." So he looked at Agnew, who was there, and Agnew said, "Mr. President, don't go. There's going to be blood running all through the streets of the South, and you don't want that blood on your hands." And the president looks at me. I'm the non-politician in the room. And I say, "Well, you're the president of the United States. Whatever happens, it's on your watch. And you've met with these people who've come up here. They're good people. And they're working." So I knew he had decided to go. But anyway, so he decides to go. So we go down there. I go down the night before with Pat. And we work with the Louisiana group, and it's not coming so well. And all of a sudden it dawns on me, it's one thing to bring people to the White House.
The White House,
It's another thing to meet in a hotel room. And
so
we were getting somewhere, but it wasn't teed up the way it usually was. And all of a sudden, president has landed. President's 10 minutes out. So on. So I have to adjourn the meeting and go to the president and say, "Well, Mr. President, it was before it was all teed up. But it's not teed up, and you've got to take it on and bring them around yourself. Sorry about that." But he did. He did it very well. And then we had the meeting. It went off well. And after the meeting is over, we get on Air Force One, and we're flying back to Washington. There was only one real Southerner in our group. It's a man named Bryce Harlow. He's a very wise man.
You remember that name?
And we're sitting talking about it, all feeling pretty good. And the president comes back from his quarters and joins the conversation. And then he turns to Bryce, the Southern. He says, "Well, Bryce, how do you think it's going to go?" He says, "Well, Mr. President, I think it's going to go very well in the South, not going to be a problem. The problem is going to be when it comes to the North, when it comes to New York and Boston and Chicago and all the people who have been preaching to us in the South. That's where
he was right there.
The president says, "Why is that?" In those days, they called him Negro. Bryce said, "Well, Mr. President, in the South, we love the Negro. We live with him. In a sense, we hate them as a race, but we love them as human beings, and we're with them all the time.
Yes,
human contact is there. Yes. The North, it's the other way around. They have no human contact.
That's right.
And they won't know how to handle it."
That's right. Ted
Bryce turned out to be very prophetic in that.
That's right. That's,
but
that's,
it was and it all came off well.
Yeah.
It came off very well.
Wow. Why is it that Republicans never, the country doesn't know that? Why don't they get credit for this kind of...
But this was not trying to get people something that they didn't deserve.
Yeah.
This was trying to get people something they did deserve.
Yeah.
To open up opportunity for people on an equal basis that was not there before. And I'd have to say that President Nixon really stepped up to the plate on this.
Well, God bless him. But it is amazing that Republicans, years go by, and the credit never, the opposite is presumed, that, you know, that he was an enemy of civil rights and so forth. And
I remember President Nixon saying, we were discussing this in the cabinet room, and somebody mentioned the politics of it. He says, "There's no politics in this." He says, "We won't get any votes as a result of this. Maybe we'll get more votes against. The only reason for doing this is because it's right."
Yeah.
And that was a little showing off when he made that statement. But still in all, that's the way he thought about it.
Well, the current president seems to have made many gestures and so forth with the clear knowledge that he too is probably not going to get a lot of political, make a lot of political hay for it, and but he's done it anyway.
Well, he's been working on the Latino issue very hard.
Yes, Yes.
And that comes out of his experience as governor of Texas and a resident of Texas.
It's
a big Latino state.
Yeah.
And he sees this problem of all the people who are here illegally as a major issue.
Yeah.
And it is a major issue.
Is.
How
it
to
is
handle
indeed.
It is, it's hard. It's not an easy problem.
Do you have any any answers or any ideas about how that a problem like that that's festered this long I kind of sympathize with them. There's no easy way out, certainly.
No easy way, but I think what the Senate Judiciary Committee reported out a bill yesterday.
Yes.
That at least sounds to me as I glance through the write-ups of it, to be on the right track, to say we have to do whatever we can to control our borders.
Yeah.
We're entitled to do that.
Yeah.
And we should do that. But then we have this big, in a sense, inventory of people who are here.
Yeah.
And mostly they're here because they're energetic and have done the effort to come here, and they're working.
Yeah.
And there's a market for them, in other words.
Yeah.
And somehow we have to figure out a way to deal with that problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to ship them home. That's not in the cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to have some way to have some penalties.
Right.
So you don't get rewarded too much for illegality.
Right.
But nevertheless, give them a chance to come in out of the cold.
Yes.
And to get themselves on a route toward citizenship, if that's what they want, or at least to have a green card where they can go back and
forth. Sure.
And somehow you have to reconcile that with the people who are waiting to come in legitimately.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think to have an immigration size of who we have come in legally be compatible with the market for their services, so that they're not displacing people and they're able to get employment when they come.
When they do come, yeah.
It's a big problem because we're a welfare state.
Sure.
And people come to the health system, they come to the welfare payments, not just to work.
Yeah.
And that's an issue. And of course, there's the other end of it too. A student comes here, does extremely well, and then you say you got to go back home. Well, maybe they want to go back home. Of course, that's for them, but we shouldn't force them to if they have a lot of contributions to make here, and we should be able to bring people here who we want that will contribute to our society.
Sure. Well, they should talk to you. That's a good outline of what it seems to me that's reasonable that would accommodate all sides.
It's hard and people are
passionate about one side or the other,
and they don't like amnesty. And people say it's true, we are a country of immigrants, so we're pro-immigrant. We're also a country that believes in the rule of law, so we don't want to reward lawlessness. So there's a dilemma there. It's not easy to know how to find your way through it.
It looks like we will, though, finally. It seems as though we'll come up with something that
I think
that touches those bases you
mentioned. Reasonable track, and I have not been personally down and tried and observed the border area, but I've heard lots of people talk about it, and a lot of it is pretty brutal.
It is.
It's not anything pretty that you want to have.
That's right.
And of course, you combine the so-called coyotes that bring people across with the drug people, and they have lots of money, and they have complete willingness to use violence.
Sure.
And you've got yourself a bundle of problems.
A bunch of problems. That's very true. Yeah. One thing I've always been curious about is during the Reagan years, and Reagan is a fascinating figure, I think, on many levels. And now there's almost a kind of revisionist history coming out about him, and I think he's beginning to get more credit as somebody who was a real thinker in some ways certainly prescient with regard to the Soviet Union, somebody who could look into that regime. And any ideas where a man like that would get, where he got this sort of confidence? And it seemed to be, you as his Secretary of State seemed to manifest the same sort of, when certainly all the elites of the world were happy to say that we should continue with détente and we should continue with, find a way to live with communists. And he was somebody who, seemingly almost out of nowhere, judged them morally and took a stand, and that he seemed to be just utterly confident about.
Perceptive to see that a lot of people don't see the degree to which Ronald Reagan brought a conceptual change to our approach to Soviet relations.
Mm-hmm.
And he, detente, said, we're here, they're there, that's life. Name of the game is peaceful coexistence.
Right.
And President Reagan said, we're here, but their system is unstable. As he said in his 1982 Westminster speech, they'll be assigned to the ash heap of history.
Yeah.
And people patted him on the head and said,
yeah,
you'll learn, boy.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that well. Yeah.
And he talked a lot about freedom and things like that.
Sure.
But he had thought about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And our colleagues here at Hoover, Kyron Skinner and Marty and Annalise Anderson, have edited this series of books. And they found these essays.
Yes.
That he wrote out in his own handwriting, so nobody can say somebody was whispering his ear. But there it is. And it's fascinating to read them because there are passages where he'll write something and then he'll cross it out. And you can read what he crossed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he re-expresses it so you can see how he was working the issue in his mind. But all these issues he had thought about deeply and wrote about. So when he came to the presidency, he had views that
he was really ready.
Understood.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that he had a view of what was a good thing politically. He had a view of what he thought. And that's why he had this attribute of being constant.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he was constant was that he'd thought it through and he had a belief and this was his belief.
Yeah.
He's comfortable with himself.
That's that's rare, it seems. I mean, it's rare in any of us, but even among presidents. I mean, it seems to me that presidents, many who even do have a fairly clear idea, though not all do, are vulnerable to polls and to shifts in public opinion and have a kind of anxiety about them. And he seemed not to have that. And I can't think of many other presidents.
Well, he was an agenda politician.
Mm-hmm.
So he came with an agenda. He came knowing what he wanted to accomplish.
Yeah.
And Margaret Thatcher was also very much the same kind. And it turned out their agendas were very parallel. Mm-hmm. So they were great mutual reinforcement.
Yes. Agenda's a good way to put it.
Her prime ministership and his presidency, they got along well and shared views, and it was a very productive relationship with her.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting the signal here that I thought we were about halfway through, but apparently we're all the way through. So thank you very much. It's been an honor.
Thank you, Shelby, for this conversation.
Happy
I appreciate
to.
It.
Thank you.
You're a person here at Hoover that I admire, and your things that you write and think,
well,
big contributions.
Thank you very much.